The Green Room with Orla Barry on News Talk.
In 2014, writer Jean Hannah Edelstein moved back to New York City following news that her father was dying from cancer. 6 weeks after she arrived, her father died. 6 months later, she learned that she had inherited the gene that caused her father's cancer. She's just published her memoir, This Really Isn't About You. Let's have a listen to Jean reading from the opening pages.
Because if I tell the story, it doesn't hurt as much. Because if I tell the story, I can get on with it. Nora Ephron, Heartburn. I was in Brooklyn looking for love on OkCupid when my father died. It was a cold February night in 2014. It was almost 2 years after the night in late spring when my parents called me on Skype. I was at home in London, and they were at home in Baltimore. And Dad looked into the camera and said, I have lung cancer. That night in February, I had a rare feeling of contentment, or something like it. After 6 weeks of not quite having a home, of living between my parents' house in Baltimore and a temporary spot in Brooklyn, I'd secured a lease on an apartment in a brownstone in Clinton Hill, a pretty neighborhood in the middle of Brooklyn. I was beginning to feel like it might be time to build my real life in America. Maybe, I thought, I could start working on finding a boyfriend. The other two things were in place. I had a job, and now I had a place to live. Maybe my life was almost under control. On the OkCupid profile I built that night, I put up a photo I'd taken of myself standing by the window in the apartment in Berlin that I had moved out of a few weeks earlier. I'd filtered the photo in black and white to make me look younger and more pretty. I put up another photo of me standing in front of a graffiti-covered swan boat in an abandoned Berlin amusement park where I had gone with some friends to celebrate my 32nd birthday. I put up a third photograph of me holding my friend's dog in my lap while he was wearing a medical cone around his neck so that it looked like I was holding a dog's head in a martini glass. I hoped that the photos represented the kind of person that I was or who I wished to be. Youngish, prettyish, an appreciator of things that are a little bit absurd, a lover of dogs. In the space for self-description, I wrote something about how I was new to New York, an ex-expat, a person who had not lived in the United States since the late 90s, a time traveler from the Clinton years. I did not note the reason that I had returned to New York. I did not write, I came back because my father is dying of lung cancer. But to the question about whether I could date a smoker, I replied, absolutely not.
And Jean Hannah Edelstein joins us now. You're very welcome to the show, Jean.
Thanks so much, Perla. It's great to be here.
We heard you there reading from the start of the book, and you feature a quote by Nora Ephron in the opening pages. Because if I tell the story, it doesn't hurt as much. Because if I tell the story, I can get on with it. Talk to me about the quote, that quote, and the significance of it for you.
So I read Heartburn, which the quote is taken from shortly after Nora Ephron died, actually, which coincidentally was around the time that my father got his lung cancer diagnosis. And if you're not familiar with Heartburn, it's a book about a really hard time in her life where she was, I think, about 7 months pregnant and then discovered that her husband was having an affair and planning to leave her. So that sounds like it could be a really sad story, but it's also just like a very, very funny book. Like she has an amazing way of kind of writing in a very sort of like deadpan way, but then also sort of like pulling out the absurdity of her situation. And so I think what struck me about the book and about the quote is the idea that when you're going through difficult times, as I did in that period of my life, it's tempting to just think of everything as terrible and then sort of to allow other people to impose their idea of how sad everything is for you onto you. So whereas by sort of like, you know, and I'm lucky as a writer that this is my inclination, by building a narrative around what's happening and being able to sort of identify the light as well as the dark, although I couldn't control the situation that I was in per se, I was able to control the narrative and then through that was able to sort of say, okay, what's next? Like, I'm just going to keep moving forward.
You do. I was going to say, because you do write with great humor in the book.
Thank you.
Yeah, with great humor. And, you know, as I describe the intro to it, people might think, gosh, this is pretty depressing. But actually, there is fantastic humor in the book. Yeah. The title, talk to us about the title of it. This Really Isn't About You.
Well, so the title is taken from a particular moment in the book where I went to see a doctor and he was sort of asking me about my my medical history and so forth and about my family history. And he asked me about my father. And I said, well, my father died in February. And then the doctor said, oh, my father also died in February. And there was this weird moment where I just thought, well, this really isn't about you. Like, I'm not here to talk to you. You know, I'm sorry, but like, it's not really relevant to this conversation.
This is my moment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I'm, you know, I live in the US, so like, I'm paying you a lot of money.
Yeah.
But it's also more broadly, I think, really about how, you know, although in the book I control the story, I'm really not in control of my life. Like, all of these things are kind of, you know, especially I learn about these inheritances that I have in terms of my DNA, but also in terms of like decisions that I make that are so clearly influenced by my family. And so more broadly, it's about how, you know, you think you're in control of your life, but it really isn't about you. It's about so much else that surrounds you, this kind of like, you know, soup of information and genetics. And so you take that as it comes and you just have to kind of make of it what you can, because ultimately, like, as self-centered as we all are, ourselves are made up of so much outside of ourselves.
Mm. What was your father diagnosed with?
So my father was diagnosed with Lynch syndrome, which is, it's a genetic cancer syndrome, which means that people with Lynch have very elevated risks of getting certain kinds of cancer. So it's in particular known to be associated with colon cancer, and in women, gynecological cancers, so endometrial cancer and ovarian cancer. However, it does increase your risk of getting basically all kinds of cancer. So although I'm not sure if to what extent my father's lung cancer was marked as being Lynch-related, it was pretty likely that it was, especially because he didn't have any other risk factors for lung cancer. Mm. So he originally found out that he had Lynch syndrome a few years before because he had a skin cancer that was associated with it.
Oh. Your siblings did the test, discovered that they didn't have the gene. You
Correct.
Waited until after he died to do the test. Why?
I think so. My siblings were perhaps more proactive than me, but they were also a bit more settled in their lives. So when my dad was originally diagnosed in 2010, he said to us, you know, you should get tested for this. And I just was very reluctant to do it. It was partly I had a hunch that I had it, although it's a 50% chance. So when you have 50-50 odds, it's pretty easy to have a hunch.
Yeah.
But on the, I think additionally, I was living in London at the time, but I was pretty unsettled in my career. I didn't have a very stable relationship. I was even, at the time I was house sitting for someone, so I didn't even really have a permanent home. Hmm. And I think my feeling was really like, I can't take on this information right now. Like, I just don't want to know. Hmm. And so, you know, it was a bit of a struggle because, and then when my father became really ill and it was clear that, you know, I think lung cancer is almost always diagnosed at a stage where it can be treated, but not, you know, not stopped. Mm-hmm. When it became clear that, you know, he was going to die, then I felt like, well, I don't want to find out that I have it and then tell him, because that seems like a very, you know, that would be very difficult for him to know when he is suffering at the end of his life. Mm. And it was, you know, my mother disagreed with that decision. My father really wanted me to get the test, but I felt for me that allowed me to also feel like I had a little bit of control, that I knew that like, okay, if I'm going to have this bad news, I can choose like who's going to be exposed to it. So I waited until 6 months after he died to get the test.
And you tested positive. So what does it
I did.
What does it mean? You were in your kind of early 30s, mid 30s at the mm-hmm. time. Mm. So what did it mean for you, and what does it mean for you then?
So, I mean, it was, you know, it was traumatizing is the only word for it, I think. Mm. I was 33. I was still, you know, deeply grieving my father, who I and all of my family was very close to. I had given up my life. I had been living in Berlin. I had given it up in order to move to New York so that I could be closer to my parents and support them at that time. So I just felt very unmoored. And then the only thing that I knew for certain was that like I would probably die of cancer one day. Mm. It's a lot to take.
Yeah, it is a lot to take. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but then, you know, then, I mean, I remember thinking like, well, at least I have a sense of humor. And then it was a matter from that point of saying, okay, I have this information. Like, what am I going to choose to do with this information? And there were definitely days where I thought I could just give up. Like, what's the point? And, you know, my life then became very medicalized, even though, touch wood, I've actually been lucky that I have been very healthy. But I now have a barrage of tests every 6 months, which are very invasive and, you know, and make me feel like I really have like lost control over my body because I have to submit to all of these invasive exams that are very unpleasant. And so it was just kind of a matter of, so there were some days where I thought, you know, why am I even bothering if this is just like written in my future? And then I sort of changed my attitude and I genuinely used to walk through the streets of Manhattan on my way to these appointments thinking like my life has value, my life has value. And that was really what kind of propelled me forward.
Wow. And were you writing all this time? Was the memoir and snippets being written as all of this was happening?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a diarist. I wasn't going home every day and like writing down what happened. But I think I would write down snippets of conversations that I had or feelings that I had or just things that I observed. I mean, I remember once coming out of one of these appointments and walking down the street and finding myself standing outside a wig shop that catered to cancer patients. And in the front window, there was this very bizarre, like, sort of, you know, head with a wig on it, and it was on a turntable, and it was just spinning very slowly. I mean, it was just whoever came up with that as a sales technique was an idiot. But anyway, I just remember, and it was like right around the corner from Memorial Sloan Kettering, which is the main cancer hospital in New York. And so I was like walking past the hospital thinking like, am I going to end up here one day? And then standing staring at this wig as it like pivoted. And the face of the wig was like sort of gray hair, but the face on the sort of mannequin was like, looked like a sort of like idealized like Latvian supermodel. And it was just, you know, and I just like stood there and watched it spin for a while. And I was just like, this is absurd. So I wrote that down. But, and it's in the book.
It's in the book. And it's in, these are the sort of the surreal tales. I should say, because when I was reading about the book initially, I was thinking, I've been reading Jean recently. And then I Googled and I thought, that's where I've been reading her. Because you are a writer, you write for different publications, but people here might be familiar with your writing in The Guardian over the last couple of months. You've been writing about IVF, and when you mentioned a little bit earlier you were single and all of this, that situation did change, and you're now married. You're down the IVF road, which I assume it's all linked with this, because you can, if you have IVF, you can eliminate potentially passing the gene on to your child.
That's correct. So I mean, it was kind of amazing. So at the time when I got the diagnosis, and then I was sort of suddenly had all this information thrown at me. One of the things, so first of all, like the recommendation for women is to have a hysterectomy as soon as you're finished with, you know, having a family, because obviously that just like, you know, totally brings down your risk of gynecological cancers. And so they said to me, well, you should have a hysterectomy. And I said, well, you know, I want to have a family and I don't have a partner. And at the time I remember like there were two people in the room and we all just went silent for a moment. And I thought, well, this is probably the saddest silence of my life. because it was something I had been single for a long time, and it was something that I sort of knew but hadn't even articulated. Like I would never have said that to anyone's face up until that moment. And then they said, well, you can do IVF, and through IVF eliminate it in your children. And IVF was just something that I had never, it was not on my radar. I knew it, you know, I knew it existed, but only in the vaguest way. And so then as I moved forward, I started learning more about it. By the time I met my husband 2 years ago, you know, I had sort of come to accept if I'm going to have a biological child, then I'm going to go down the IVF route. And so I had actually specifically sought out a job where the health insurance would cover it. So in that way, I feel very fortunate, because I know for a lot of people, like infertility comes as a shock and they aren't necessarily in a position where it's easy to start the treatment or fund the treatment. So my husband and I started IVF about a year ago now. And through the genetic testing, they're able to test the embryos to see if they had Lynch syndrome. And because of that, we were then able to transfer an embryo that doesn't have it. And so I'm now almost 6 months pregnant.
Ah, fantastic. Congratulations. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I know, because your husband wrote in The Guardian about the experience of having a partner going through IVF, which was a little bit different from your experience.
Definitely.
So it's interesting to see it from the other person's eyes as well. Yeah. Well, you can read about some of Jean's experiences in her new book. It is entitled This Really Isn't About You, Jean Hannah Edelstein. Exactly. It's been lovely to talk to you, and thanks so much for taking the time out for us this evening.
Thank you so much, Orla.
News Talk 106 to 108.